And having not yet reached a quorum, we will officially bring the meeting to order when we do have a quorum. And I'm happy to chair the committee today since we don't have any rules. And I have the gavel. I will start the committee. And, you know, it's true that you know, don't stop believing. One day even a freshman can chair the tax committee at least one time.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, I was appointed to chair the education committee, and the very first hearing, we had a huge snowstorm. And this predated cell phones. Everybody knows I've been around a while. And I'm sitting on 94 at a dead stop. So I finally got there about a half hour late, and my immediate past predecessor from your caucus, because we had just gone into the majority, was chairing the meeting. So I understand when you have to take over.
No, I found the gavel.
And he just did that as a volunteer because people were waiting and nobody knew where I was because he couldn't communicate in those days. But anyway, just a short footnote to your comments.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. The meeting is officially gaveled then. Representative Swedinski is the first to present House File 513. When the quorum is present, we will formally move the bill. And please introduce your bill, Chair Swedinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I appreciate the opportunity, Chair Kosnick, to come before your committee. I wouldn't mind just real quick, if I could have someone move the DE1 amendment, which is just a technical cleanup. I thought we gambled. Okay, sorry about that. So House File 513, essentially it really goes after, kind of an equal playing field portion of state law when it comes to the working family credit. Just for a little bit of background, the working family credit really is available only to low-income individuals who have no income tax liability. If tribal members living and working on the reservation attempt to report on reservation income for purposes of calculating the working family tax credit, that income is exempt currently under federal law. This bill would permit that income to be calculated determining working family tax credit eligibility. Currently, tribal members living and working on reservations are citizens of Minnesota, and the law needs to be clear that all working families in the state are entitled to this benefit. And I think this is just an issue of fairness, and I think really getting our state and our state laws where they need to be when it comes to these programs. And with that, I have Lee LeBeau to help testify upon the bill, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Swedinski. Before we go to the testifier, Ms. Manzi, could you maybe give a little background on the tax credit in the bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the working family credit is a credit that supplements earned income of low-income filers. So it is calculated as a percentage of earnings up to a maximum earning amount, and then there's what's called a plateau where the credit remains flat, and then it phases out as income increases above a second threshold. That's a phase-out threshold. And actually, if you want to see what those income levels are, they appear in the bill summary for the second bill that you'll have before you today, House File 516. There's a provision in our state working family credit statute that says that if the earnings that you have are not taxable by the state of Minnesota, then you have to apportion your credit based on the share of your income that is taxable by the state of Minnesota. And then there are exceptions to that for combat pay and for another kind of military income that's deducted under our subtractions for members of the National Guard and Reserves and people who have active service pay that's not combat pay. What this bill proposes to do is to add an exception to that for on-reservation earnings of enrolled tribal members who live and work on the reservation of which they are a member of that tribe, because that income is not taxable by states under federal law. So currently, individuals in that situation have to apportion their earned income, their state working family credit, and it effectively disallows the credit for someone whose entire income is from wages earned on the reservation.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Manzi. If there's no questions, I will go to Mr. Reed LeBeau to testify on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Reed LeBeau with the Jacobson Law Group. Wanted to thank Chair Swazinski for bringing this bill. I also want to recognize and thank Representative Allen, who I have the pleasure of working with away from the Capitol, but many may not know that she's probably one of the best experts in tribal tax policy in the nation. And so we worked on this over the summer trying to get the language together. I can't explain it any better than staff did, but just exactly as Chair Swazinski said, this is really an issue of a very complex federal overlay of the exemption of on-reservation income. And so this just clarifies that that income, the state is not taxing it, but it's eligible for calculation of whether or not somebody's entitled and eligible for the working family tax credit.
Very good. Thank you. Not seeing any questions? Is the Department of Revenue nothing? Okay. Okay. When a quorum is here, then we'll move the file in your amendment. Chair Swazinski, do you have any final comments?
Certainly. I appreciate the opportunity to come before the committee, and I appreciate the amendment being adopted as written when we do have quorum. And you know, getting the bill to be considered into the omnibus tax bill. So, thank you.
Okay,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, I think we got a little time here. Those delicious pastries that are being sent around here. Remember yesterday, Representative Frankie came in as a freshman and first bill in front of the tax committee. He worked hard this morning to get him here for us. So, if you see. Representative Frankie, make sure you thank him.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. That's right. Representative Frankie, if you're watching, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Nabla.
Hey, can I ask the author one more question or read?
Okay.
Is there any kind of a calculation on how much income tax the state would collect if we could tax Indians that were earning money on the reservation? I mean, I wouldn't, well, I guess it depends on which reservation, but I wouldn't necessarily think it's a lot on at least a lot of reservations.
Mr. Chairman, Chair Knoppel, I'm not aware of any study that said what exactly that would be, but again, that issue has been long resolved by the U.S. Supreme Court. And outside the purview of anything that we're discussing today.
Okay, yeah, and Mr. Chair, I'm not suggesting that we should do it. I mean,
sure, now, like, if I could just quick, we'll have a quorum, so we'll gather the meeting in order. Go ahead and proceed.
Okay. It does seem odd that we aren't offering a credit to these individuals who are Minnesotans, even though I understand there is a different tax classification here. So, anyway, I just thought I'd ask that question. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Chair Nabok, thank you for recognizing that. And our understanding is it was basically just an oversight that this wasn't, because it is so highly technical, and you have the state and the federal tax overlay issues, that's what we're trying to clean up. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Nabok. And Representative Grunhagen, would you move the bill and the amendment, please?
Yeah, I'll move House File 513. If I was paying attention.
513.
513, and I would also move the amendment.
Any questions on the DE amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Amendment's adopted. And Representative Swazinski moves House File 5. Representative Grunhagen moves House File 513 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill as amended. Okay. Representative Schultz, would you like to move the minutes for the hearing on February 8th? Any additions or corrections?
Some.
Been moved. All those in favor of appointing the minutes say aye. Those opposed. Say aye. Those opposed say nay. The minutes for February 8th are approved. Representative Loeffler moves her bill, House File 516. Please introduce the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And House File 516 is another bill dealing with the Working Family Tax Credit, but it addresses the issues statewide for all people who might qualify for this credit. And I'd like to first offer the A1 amendment.
Thank you.
And what this is a technical amendment which updates the language based on our passage of the Federal Conformity Bill, which had some minor differences in the statute. So we're just making sure it fits the law as we have now got it standing.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Members, are there any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay. Amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Well, the Working Family Tax Credit encourages work, and it helps workers and their families get off to a good start. It's the Minnesota partner to the Federal Earned Income Tax Credit. It's been a long time part of our tax proposal, and this mirrors what was in the tax bill that didn't make it through in 2016, and it benefits people across the state with the highest participation rates in rural areas, almost but not quite 400,000 households. Around 370,000 households throughout the state benefit from this. And it really goes to our lowest income working households who are living paycheck to paycheck and shortly away from financial disaster when an unexpected medical cost or the used car breaks down again or something else enters in. And it's been proven through a lot of research over time to really get people off to a good start getting financial stability. In fact, the majority of people don't stay on it for more than a few years, but it helps them during that early part of their career. The economic benefits of this is that it stays in the community. These are people who are living paycheck to paycheck. They're going to use it for local goods and services to support themselves and their family members. And it what this bill will do is it'll modestly increase the size of the credit and make more eligible by updating and increasing the income just to, so that people can earn. And I had this passed out, this kind of graphic, because I think as Ms. Manzi explained, the formula is a little different than some of them that we have with the plateau and things, but I think this graphically shows how it's really just a modest increase, an adjustment to deal with the increased cost of living that these families have been experiencing over time. And it, of course, the biggest benefit is to those with two or more children, and the program in itself is oriented more towards families than people without dependents. And with that, I would like to introduce Nan Madden from the Minnesota Budget Project of the Council of Nonprofits.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Ms. Madden, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nan Madden. I am director of the Minnesota Budget Project. I want to thank Representative Loeffler for bringing this bill forward. And it's too bad Representative David is not here today, because I would have thanked him for being the author of a similar bill last year, as well as the 2016 omnibus tax bill, which included these provisions. Also wanted to just express appreciation for Representative Swedinsky's bill to address inequity that exists in this credit currently. You will consider many different tax cuts proposals this year, and we think this is an important one to add to the mix because it is focused on Minnesotans working their way into the middle class. As Representative Loeffler mentioned, the Working Family Credit is Minnesota's version of the Federal Earned Income Tax Credit. A majority of states have similar credits like this one that builds on the federal credit's documented success in supporting work and providing long-lasting benefits for children. The research shows that children and families that receive credits like this one are healthier, they do better in school, they're more likely to go to college and earn more as adults. This is a tax credit that can only be claimed by households with earnings from work, and it refunds a portion of the significant state and local taxes, not just income taxes, but sales taxes and other taxes that these Minnesotans pay. The families and workers who receive the Working Family Credit can be found all across the state. 48% live in Greater Minnesota and 52% in the seven-county metro area. The Working Family Credit is especially effective in reaching those communities where good-paying jobs are harder to find, including parts of Greater Minnesota and in our communities of color. In fact, in Greater Minnesota, nearly 14% of all tax-filing households receive the Working Family Credit. And I did provide some information to the committee of the importance of the Working Family Credit for every county in the state. You will hear in a few minutes from Ms. Brown, who has received the Working Family Credit, and her story underlines the difference that these tax credits can make in Minnesotans' lives. For families like hers, who are working hard but struggling to make ends meet, receiving the Working Family Credit means she can afford some of her family's most basic expenses. And because families receive their tax refunds once a year after they file their taxes, many families use them to build their savings or otherwise take steps towards a stronger economic future. And as a result, our communities across the state benefit as Minnesotans use those tax refunds in their local businesses. This bill expands the Working Family Credit in three ways. First, it increases the size of the credit that most currently eligible households and workers can receive. It increases the incomes that households can earn and remain eligible for the credit, and that does make some additional households eligible. So, for example, a married couple with one child would be eligible with incomes just under $48,000, and a married couple with two children eligible at $53,815. And finally, this bill lowers the age requirement that currently applies to workers and married couples that don't have dependent children. Right now, under current law, those people need to be at least 25 years old to qualify for the credit. This bill would lower that to 21. They still would have to be independent, not dependents of another taxpayer, but we lower that age requirement. With today's tightening labor market and a coming labor shortage, the state's economic future depends on every Minnesotan being able to succeed in the workforce, and the Working Family Credit can help us reach that goal. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Madden.
Mr. Chair, my next testifier will be from Prepare and Prosper, Taylor Poots.
Mr. Poots? Putz, okay. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Taylor Putz, and I'm the Communications and Engagement Manager at Prepare and Prosper. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House File 516, the expansion of the Working Family Credit, by introducing Kalina Brown, who has been a customer of Prepare and Prosper for the past 5 years and a recipient of the Working Family Credit. Prepare and Prosper is a nonprofit organization based in St. Paul. We provide free tax preparation and financial services to over 13,500 low and moderate income individuals and families in the metro and return over $25 million in refunds. We also assist more than a dozen organizations throughout the state to operate their free tax preparation sites. Individuals like Kalina work one-on-one with an IRS-certified volunteer to file their taxes. Their tax returns are then reviewed by a quality reviewer to ensure accuracy. Because of tax credits like the Working Family Credit, tax time presents low-income working people with the opportunity to use their refund to save for a rainy day, pay down debt, or make important purchases. As a result, at each of our tax sites, we have free financial services where our customers can open savings accounts, purchase U.S. savings bonds, start a MyRA retirement account, and make savings plans, as well as pull credit reports or refer them to our financial coaching program or debt counseling at Lutheran Social Services of Minnesota. As you'll hear from Kalina in just a moment, tax time has been a powerful time for her and her family in giving them the opportunity to build a stronger financial future. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Putz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Kalina. Kalina and her young child will be joining us now to talk from a recipient's perspective.
Excellent. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Brown. Introduce yourself and who you have there with us.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members.
Good morning.
I'm Kalina Brown, and this is Caden Eggleston. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House File 516, an extension of the Working Family Credit. As a working mom, I have to make a lot of choices. Sometimes they're easy, like deciding what to make for dinner, fish or chicken. Other times I have to look at my bank account and make decisions on what bills to pay, rent or car insurance. About 2 years ago, I lost my job working at an elementary school because the school lost funding, so I began to look for another job. I came across one working as a RAM agent at the airport, and by taking this job, I knew that it would come with a significant pay cut, but I couldn't risk turning it down because I needed the income to pay for bills, groceries, and other necessities. Soon after taking this job, I remember opening my car insurance bill, and my old job paying for car insurance wasn't a problem. But now I was worried about having to choose between paying for auto insurance or paying for rent. It kept me up at night. My car is a necessity. I use it to travel to and from work and to pick up my 3-year-old son from daycare. The bus system didn't match with my work schedule because sometimes I have to work evenings at the airport and the closest bus stop is 20 minutes from my apartment. Around this time, I also, that was when I filed taxes at Prepare and Prosper. I worked with a volunteer one-on-one for the free tax preparation. The volunteer tax preparer informed me that because of my earned income and family size that I would receive the Minnesota Working Family Credit. I remember this moment like it was yesterday because I felt a sense of freedom and relief that I could use a portion of my tax refund from the Working Family Credit to pay for my car insurance. This meant that I didn't have to choose. I could pay my rent and pay for my car insurance. As a recipient of the Family Working Credit, I've also been able to worry less about paying bills and being, and I can focus more on my future and my son's future. My son is my main focus. More than ever, I want to give him a leg up so that he can thrive. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I hope you will support this legislation that will expand the Working Family Credit so more hardworking Minnesotans can use it to make important steps towards a more secure future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Brown. Does the department not want to offer any testimony on this file? Thank you.
And we have one more testifier, Mr. Chairman, from the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. Do you want to take Ann Kuznick first?
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you, Representative Loeffler.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ann Kuznick. I'm the Executive Director of the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, which is made up of the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the Minnesota Council of Churches, the Jewish Community Relations Council, and the Islamic Center of Minnesota. And we represent, encompass within about three-quarters of people of faith in Minnesota. In our places of worship, we hear exactly the same things that you just heard from the previous testifier, people really struggling to pay their rent, to pay for gas or repairs, to afford healthy food for their children, and to buy diapers. And we are here in support of the Working Family Credit. As was very clear, this is for working Minnesotans. They're low and moderate income. And the credit allows them to build assets and to really move toward financial stability. When people in our churches talk to folks who get the Working Family Credit, they're using it for things like making repairs, long overdue repairs on a car, or using it as a down payment on a more reliable car. They're using it for first and last month's rent in order to move their families into a safer neighborhood. They're using it for coats and boots and shoes for their children, paying off bills they've been juggling. And in many cases, it's maybe the first opportunity they have to really start developing savings that they can use if they have a medical emergency or they have a need for funds for some other reason. The Working Family Credit promotes work. It is a proven asset-building tool. And on behalf of people of faith across the state, we ask that you include the expansion of the Working Family Credit in the bill. Thank you. In your final bill.
Thank you, Ms. Kuznick. And Representative Loeffler, I see in the packet there's a statement from Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. Did you want to comment on that at all as a board member on there? I would appreciate some comments if you have any. Otherwise, members just know that it's in there.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate your service on that board, and perhaps you could even speak more to their discussion of it. But I do think that we appreciate their speaking up on behalf of that community and what a difference it makes for them. And we also have in the packet, as Ms. Madden pointed out, information on how the geographic distribution of recipients.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And I guess I will just take the opportunity just to read it since we have a little bit of time. The Council on Latino Affairs supports policies that promote work. Minnesota Latinos are one of the youngest populations in the state and also proudly own the state's highest labor participation rate. Thus, Latinos have an increasingly important role in the Minnesota's economy. And despite leading the state in labor force participation, the Latino average poverty rate is higher than the state average. House File 516 will raise the eligible income limits for receiving the working family credit, and more Latino households can benefit from the credit. So that's in your packet, members. So I just wanted to point that out, and I appreciate the council providing that testimony for us. And not seeing any other questions, Representative Chernoblock.
Well, I can, if Mr. Cummings is going to testify, I just let him testify, then I've got some questions for the author afterwards.
Okay, that sounds good. Mr. Cummings from the Department of Revenue, please offer your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. It's good to see you in a different location today. And Representative Loeffler and members, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I was able to connect with Representative Loeffler's office before the hearing. Mr. Chair, I first wanted to say that I thought that Ms. Brown's testimony was very compelling, and I think sometimes we talk a lot about working families in Minnesota, and I thought that that Ms. Brown was very, very compelling, and I think that her testimony speaks to the amount of hard work that's happened across Minnesota and how we can be partners with them in making Minnesota the best state possible. Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith supports House File 516, the proposal to increase the working family credit. The proposal expands the working family credit by providing access to the maximum amount of the credit at lower income levels, providing access to 21 to 24-year-olds, and increasing the amount of the credit for over 260,000 taxpayers who already receive it. This proposal expands the working family credit to 107,000 new taxpayers. This credit is designed to encourage and reward work, and the bill before you will make it more effective. Studies show that credits like this encourage large numbers of single parents to work, especially when the labor market is strong. Much like proposals put forward in Washington last year by Speaker Paul Ryan, this proposal would also increase the credit for childless workers who currently can only receive a maximum possible benefit of $134, which fully phases out when income reaches $15,000. Many low and middle income families haven't seen their wages rise while their cost of living has increased. This credit, which also exists at the federal level, helps working families deal with the many financial constraints they face. The program is an important source of financial stability for low and moderate working families with children. A growing body of research shows that the credit benefits families at virtually every stage of life. For example, it improves infant and maternal health, reduces poverty, improves academic performance and employment outcomes. Children and families receiving the federal credit do better in school and are more likely to attend college and earn more as adults. It boosts employment, which reduces the number of households receiving other forms of assistance. It helps businesses. Working families are likely to put these funds back into Minnesota's economy. The average family would save an additional $124 a year. A single taxpayer with two children would receive a maximum credit of over $2,000 in the income range of $13,000 to $25,000. The credit would phase down for an individual above $25,000, reaching zero at $48,000. As this bill moves through the process, Mr. Chair, the Department of Revenue looks forward to working with you, Chair Davids, Representative Loeffler, and staff. we thank the committee for the opportunity to be a resource.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cummings. We have a couple questions. We'll start with Chair Knobloch.
Well, I might have a question for Mr. Cummings. Mr. Cummings, is this, or Representative Loeffler, is this the governor's proposal, what's in his budget?
Mr. Chair, from what I understand, this is a proposal that has been developed throughout the past few years. It was an approach that is substantially similar, if not the same, as what was in House File 848. The governor took what was in House File 848 and has put that in his budget for this year. So as much as to say this is the governor's proposal, this is really the proposal that has worked on by many that the governor has adopted into his approach.
Okay, well, so it's in the governor's budget. So, Representative Loeffler, you talked about the need to do this to kind of update it for inflation, I think I heard. Is that right?
Well,
Representative Knobloch,
we all know the cost of living has been going up dramatically, and particularly for people who aren't spending on the luxury goods, but on the basics. If you look at information that's been provided by the Affordable Housing Advocates on just rental income, costs going up, on utility costs going up, the basics of life, groceries are still going up. In fact, some communities are finding it's going up even more because they're losing grocery stores. And so the basics of life have really been going up much faster than people's incomes. And at this particular income range, people are really the working poor. They're getting up every day, they're going to work, they're earning their paycheck, but it doesn't stretch as far when costs that they can't control continue to escalate. And so it isn't directly correlated to a CPI number. It is a reflection of a modest increase to recognize the fact that the rents, housing costs, utilities, food have been going up.
Representative Loeffler, I'm not disputing that, but I guess when was it last updated for inflation? Do you know, or Mr. Cummings, do you know?
2013. Mr. Chair, I know that there were revisions that were made in the 2014 legislature to the Working Family Credit, but I would defer to Ms. Manzi or Mr. Michael about other changes that had been made to the Working Family Credit.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess the question I really have is sort of either Mr. Cummings on behalf of the governor or Representative Loeffler, why you sort of devised it this way. Because if we're updating it for inflation, on one hand I see that we're raising the dollar level at which it completely phases out. Well, that makes sense in terms of updating it for inflation. But you haven't changed the amount of money that people actually get as a maximum, except for the people who don't have any children, which is a very, very low number. So that hasn't been updated for inflation. And you haven't updated for inflation the amount of money at which it starts to phase out. So, I mean, if it, you know, started to phase out at, I don't know, whatever it was, $29,000 before for a family with two or more children, it's still phasing out at that level underneath this bill. So that hasn't been updated for inflation either. But you have, on the lower side, now sort of steepened the curve and said that people now get up to the maximum level more quickly than they did before. And so I guess I'm just trying to understand if this is supposed to be updating it for inflation. It seems like there's a lot of things that weren't updated for inflation. And why is that?
Mr. Cummings or Representative Loeffler?
Mr. Chair and Representative Knobloch, you know, it's always the choice in terms of we might do all of those things and then come up with a much larger, more expensive bill. I tend to think that the people who are at the lower ends of this are the most economically fragile and what's much more likely to potentially lose housing, go into much more expensive housing shelter costs that are picked up by property taxpayers through counties and other resources. And so the most economically vulnerable group at this point is the lowest income. If you were interested in also raising the maximums and increasing the size of this, I would definitely be open to that sort of proposal.
Mr. Cummings, is that sort of the position of the governor too?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, Representative Knobloch, what we have seen out there is research over and over and over again find that the working family credit has been a positive tool to be used to bring people who are working out of poverty and to provide other outcomes, in terms of the greater society. These have not only been studies that have been done by, traditionally progressive, these are also conservatives as well. So as we're trying to see how do we ensure that we can extend this tool to reduce poverty and to bring people into the, workforce, we're finding that, these modifications will help to do that, both by expanding the credit for some that are have smaller incomes, as well as increasing the phase down so that it extends to more people. Also, as Speaker Ryan put in his bill last year, there is an enhanced benefit for childless adults, as we're trying to ensure that, all people are able to access this sort of credit that can hopefully help to move them to produce more income.
Mr. Chair, I just closed with a comment. I think the working family credit, there is a lot of good research that shows that it's useful for people. I just was puzzled by the way this one was designed, because if it was being sold under the idea that we've had inflation, which we've had some, and we needed to update it for that, we're not really updating it for inflation in the way one would normally do that. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Knobloch. We've got a couple of people. We'll go Sarah Anderson, Hertas, Representative Hertas, Representative Anderson, Representative Draskowski, Representative Marquardt, and Carlson. Go ahead, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummins, I've got a couple of questions, one for Mr. Cummings and one for Representative Loeffler. Mr. Cummings, what has the department done, or do they do this at all? Do they have any oversight on compliance, or I shouldn't say compliance, are they checking eligibility for the credit at all, or what are we doing on the state level for this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson.
Mr. Cummings.
Madam Chair, we at the Department of Revenue, our vision is that all taxpayers report, receive, and pay the right amount, no more, no less. And we, and that extends to all taxpayers. And so one of the things that we cannot do is to share sort of audit criteria. We can tell you that we really strive to ensure that people are paying and receiving the right amount. This is a refundable credit, and so in these instances, we also want to ensure compliance as much as possible, because not only are there instances in which the credit is being used to cover tax liability, it is also beyond the tax liability. So, we do have a responsibility to make sure that the claims that are produced in the forms are actually the amount that they are able to receive. And we take that seriously. So I don't know. I want to make sure that I'm not revealing too much about audit criteria, and maybe we can try and figure out what the best way to answer that question is. I'm not sure if I'm answering that very well, but.
Chair Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe Representative Loeffler can help me out. I don't think that your bill does this, but I want to see if you have an appetite for this. But U.S. Department of Treasury and also the IRS has looked at the earned income tax credit and has found that it's on a high level of areas where fraud and abuse has taken place. And if you look just on the national level, it ranges anywhere from 28% to even 39% of fraud and abuse. And what's even more alarming, it's not just that people are claiming the credit and claiming the wrong amount, they just aren't even eligible for the credit in the first place. And so if you were to look at Minnesota, and even if you were to go lower, so on the federal level, they're saying it's anywhere from 28% to 39% level of abuse, meaning people are getting the credit that are not eligible for it. In fact, 79 to 89% of the people aren't even eligible for one penny of the credit. And if you were to take those numbers and say, okay, well, we're just going to use 25%, so even lower what they are saying the averages are on the national level. So just taking a 25%, Minnesota pays out $270 million in this tax credit. So if you take 25% of that, we're having $67 million that are going to people that are not eligible for it and that they're making fraudulent claims. And $67 million, you know, that's a chunk of money that could be directed elsewhere. So just, is it your plan then to try and address that issue here in the state so that we're not having $67 million going out the window to people that don't qualify?
Representative Loeffler?
Well, Mr. Chairman, and I and Ms. Madden have talked about this. She's looked into it even more than I have, and I think that some of that information is a bit dated. I think Congress has made some changes to streamline and make it easier for people to avoid making mistakes in it, but I'd like to have Ms. Madden answer that more fully.
Ms. Madden, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson, for that question. You know, certainly compliance and integrity in our tax system is important to all of us. My understanding, and I don't know if you've seen different data than I have, my understanding of the 22 to 26% percentage is not as a fraud number, but an error rate, and includes unintentional errors. The rules around who can claim a child are a bit complicated, and people with complex family situations sometimes get tripped up in the rules. So I think we need to make a distinction between unintentional errors, and I think also some of the numbers I've seen that sometimes get described as a fraud rate includes both underpayments and overpayments. So it also includes people who were qualifying for a credit but got a little more than was expected. So I think you know, not knowing exactly which figures that you're looking at, but the ones I've seen that correspond to the 22 to 26% is not a fraud number, but includes other kinds of unintentional errors.
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Madden, Representative Loeffler. When you're looking at this is a program that's been in place for quite some time, and they've been working on it to fix this fix this problem, and it's never been fixed. So it's still at the 20% range. It's still considered by the Department of Treasury at the high level of risk for fraud, abuse, or if you want to call it unintentional errors that are taking place. And so my concern is that impacts us here on the state level and what we pay out. And that's why I asked the question, Mr. Cummings, what kind of Department of Revenue, what kind of resources do you dedicate toward making sure that, however you want to phrase it, people are claiming it erroneously or fraudulently or whatever, if you can help me out on that.
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, I will get you some more specific figures about what we can share, but I do know that in terms of there are many times, and I want to say that the Department of Treasury and the IRS does a good job. I think that we do a very good job in terms of working with these populations to ensure that that the amount that is claimed is checked, and then that we are doing the right amount to either fix an error or to make sure that they're getting the right amount of refund. So this could be anything from immediately when the claim comes in that we will send a letter back to a taxpayer asking for some additional information. This could be something in which the department would work with the taxpayer to fix a calculation error. It could also be that a credit may be disallowed. But Minnesota has done a very good job at doing that. I also wanted to note that if there is a figure about what is claimed, that is that may not, all of that money is not necessarily income that would be disallowed, you know, the 67, and that we do a very good job at ensuring that, you know, people are paying the right amount. Now, I can't say that when the claim comes in to what the refund goes out, we want to ensure that is what's allowed under current law, and we try and you know, make sure that we are stopping or changing as much as possible. But you know, in terms of the difference between the claim and the difference between what goes out. I'd like to be able to get more information for Representative Anderson.
Representative Anderson?
Mr. Chair, just a comment. If we're relying on the feds to, you know, provide some of this data, I'm just a little concerned because they, for decades, have been having problems with this area in particular. They had set a goal in 2014 to get it, get all of their tax credit fraud overpayment, however you want to phrase it, under 10%, and this is at a, you know, significantly higher area. And so I'm interested in knowing exactly what the Department of Revenue does to check this piece, and would encourage Representative Loeffler to see what we can do here on the state level to tighten this down to make sure that the resources that we have here in the state level are actually going to the people that need it the most. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, this is not an area that I know a little bit about, not as much, I haven't looked at it as much as you have, but my understanding is that a lot of it is a confusion about who gets to claim a dependent of the two parents. And you know, I am always looking for prevention solutions rather than catch gotcha after people have made mistakes. I always think if we can get ahead of the stream, and I'm wondering if, and I'm not, you know, nothing about family law, I'll admit that, but whether or not in divorce court and in those arrangements, if that was clarified and agreed to at that time, we might actually forestall a lot of that, where both parents of goodwill claim it and don't understand that it has to be apportioned to one or the other, and that maybe we could look to some other ways to reducing that error rate than through audit approaches, but rather instead clarifying for families who are breaking up and changing responsibilities to have that clarified as part of that decision.
Okay. Is that okay, Representative Anderson? Okay, we'll go Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question pertains to the data that we have in the file and just kind of understanding some of the mechanics of this information. Now, one thing here is showing 87 counties and the number of households within the counties. And I was wondering if Mr. Cummins might know. I saw you moving on the side of my peripheral vision here. Thank you, Mr. Cummins.
Yeah, Representative McDonald's wide angle.
Yeah, wide angle lens. It shows what percent of households are receiving the working family credit, but I think it's more relevant to know what percent of families that are eligible for the working family credit receive it.
Mr. Cummins?
Mr. Chair, I think I'm going to defer to Ms. Madden.
Ms. Madden?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We never have exact figures about people who aren't involved in the system. The research I've seen at a national level around the federal earned income tax credit, which would be similar, often estimates a 75% to 80% participation rate of eligible households. I saw those numbers a number of years ago, so I'm not sure if that is still the case, but there's a really pretty strong infrastructure in the state of both nonprofit organizations like Prepare and Prosper, but also paid preparers to assist people in receiving these credits. So it's thought that the reach on this is better than some other assistance programs that people may be eligible for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my next question relates to the application of the credit. It appears that, if I look at this graphic here, it appears that families with children kind of reach the maximum credit at about $15,000 or so as proposed, and maybe a little bit further up the scale as currently it exists. So when this credit is applied, is it really a credit against the withholding, and if so, is the credit received as maximizing the refund? Or part two of this question is, if there wasn't sufficient withholding compared to the amount of credit earned, do they actually get a check back for taxes that they did not pay?
Ms. Madden?
Mr. Chair, Representative Perkoff. It is, so this is not necessarily a credit only against the income tax. It also is meant to offset some of the other kinds of state and local taxes that Minnesotans pay. It does take into account, so for example, if a family was eligible for a certain amount of working family credit and they still had income tax liability, it would be used first to pay off that income tax liability, and the remainder could come as a refund. Did I answer your question? Or?
Well, I guess you, Representative Perkoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you raised another point that I hadn't considered, but so you're saying that it would be first offset, but my question is, for example, if somebody earned a $2,000 working credit, but after their withholding schedules and whatnot only had $1,500 of withholding, would they then in fact get a check for $500?
Ms. Madden?
I'm not sure if I'm totally following your question. Let me try to answer it, and if I haven't hit it, we'll try again. If a family was eligible for a working family credit of $2,000 and they had $500 of income tax liability, they would come back, they would get $1,500 back. But how much they receive in the actual refund credit will be impacted both whether they have income tax liability or some withholding coming back. That's one calculation in their total refund. And then this would interact with that. I'm not sure I'm answering your question. I'm sorry.
Representative Perkoff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, let me be more specific for an example. Let's just say a family had many more than two children, and they had many personal exemptions that, or withholding exemptions, so that they're maximizing their net paycheck, and they might have had only $1,500 of withholding from their paycheck when they file their return with regard to state income tax, and they have earned a $2,000 earned income or working income credit, would they in fact get a cash refund for the difference? So they had...
Ms. Madden?
Yeah, let me try to answer it this way. The amount of withholding does not directly impact the amount of working family credit that a family would qualify for. So in terms of how much of a refund a family receives, there's, Mr. Cummings will correct me if I get this wrong. If we think about how much people owe in state income tax and their withholding and how those relate together, if their withholding is smaller than what they owe in state income tax, then they would have a refund coming back from that withholding. If it was the other way around, then they would still owe. So if their withholding didn't cover what they owed in income tax, they would still have some income tax owing. If they still had some income tax owing, their working family credit would go towards paying that income tax still owed, and then if there was a remainder, that would come back as a refundable expense.
Representative?
Mr. Chair, maybe Mr. Michael understands my question. I'm trying to ascertain whether or not a filer who doesn't have a lot of withholding but has earned the maximum income credit under this program actually would get a check from the state in excess of what was withheld.
Mr. Michaels?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hertas, yes, this is a refundable credit. And so let's hypothesize that the taxpayer sets their withholding to zero because they know that they will not have any income tax liability. They will get from the Department of Revenue a check to make up the difference to get what their credit is. So it is, a cash assistance program in some ways.
All right. Thank you,
Representative.
I finally got a yes. All right. And so with that in mind, it looks like, looking at this table here, that perhaps this might be a circumstance for most people under $15,000 of income that they would be getting a refundable credit. And I guess my question to the department would be, I don't do taxes. I hate taxes. I pay somebody to do that, and I have no recollection of
of where the withholding tables are, at which point you begin to pay state income taxes based on income. But would it not, or maybe it already is set up this way, would it not make more sense simply to not withhold or have our tax tables adjusted so that everybody was going home in this lower income level without any withholding and just have a larger check each month to take care of their needs?
Mr. Cummings, I think that question was for you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Hurtas, I think it's a great question. And I, to be honest, sitting here, I don't know, maybe Mr. Michael and Ms. Manzi knows in terms of our withholding schedules, but I think that's right in terms of trying to ensure that our withholding tables are as close to what the tax liability will be at the end of the year. Obviously, as our tax code becomes more complicated and there are more credits and deductions, that becomes a harder job. We want to make sure that the withholding tables are sufficient so that people aren't surprised at the end of the year in terms of tax liabilities. But to say that we want to ensure that there's adequate amount of resources in people's hands, you know, I think that's a worthy goal. And so as much as we want to, I think we would be interested in thinking about that and partnering that on that. Assistant Commissioner Steenblock was before this committee. Time seems to fly by. I don't know if it was last week or the week before. She talked about ensuring that the withholding tables are up to date is something that she's looking at. I know that that's something we're committed to. Thank you, Representative Pertas.
Thank you. Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my closing comment would be I would certainly advocate for efficiency in our system and not take people's money in order to give a little bit back to them. So I just think there's efficiency there certainly would be more useful to people every week when they get a paycheck than to wait till the end of the year to get something like this.
Okay, thank you for your comments. We've got four on the list. The next with Representative Gostkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Most of my questions, I think, have been asked or addressed or looked at. This is a particular tax expenditure. I know that I hear a lot in my district, a lot of frustrations from people, and it's interesting how we've developed the tax code, and I listen to the discussion here, and we talk about refundable tax credit and all the different matrices put forward here, but members, what we have here is a redistribution of wealth. We are taking money from people who earn it and giving it to people who haven't earned it in an effort to, we should simply call this a welfare program because that's what we have here. Question for Mr. Cummings. Mr. Cummings and Representative Anderson asked about the audit stuff that you may or may not be doing, but have we ever published an audit on this program? I read the IRS audit on the earned income credit. I'd be interested, have we ever done anything like it? You and her had a discussion about your internal efforts as a department, but it would behoove us to do, at least if this is what we have in law, to make certain that the money is going out to the people the way that it's supposed to be. Certainly the parallel program at the federal level seems to be rampant with 25% to 35% of that money not actually being qualified for. And as I look at the numbers, a lot of times the paid tax preparers or the tax preparers generally are the ones who contribute to a lot of those. So, Mr. Cummings, what have we done? Have we done anything in the past? Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, Chair Gostkowski, I wanted to... I don't know if there has been an OLA report, but I do want you to know that the Department of Revenue is constantly reviewing our practices to ensure that we are working on anything from calculation errors to anything to fraud prevention and detection. I know we, as technology has improved, we have tried to use that as much as possible to improve our ability to increase thinking about ways in which we can use leverage technology to help with fraud prevention and detection. And I will say that, you know, if you would ask other states State Department of Revenues across the country, bipartisanly. I'm not sure if that's a word, but I'm going to use it. That, you know, we would be, the Minnesota Department of Revenue would be seen as a leader in fraud prevention and detection. I look at some of the colleagues, my colleagues who are doing that work, and they are, you know, they are recognized as leaders in the field in fraud prevention and detection. The legislature in the 2016 session put additional resources into fraud prevention and detection. So this is something that we take seriously. And as we think about ways in which we can continue to improve the service to our taxpayers and to ensure that people are paying the right amount under current law, we'd be interested in continuing to partner with you. But I wanted to ensure at a bottom line that this continues to be a program that produces positive outcomes for Minnesotans and the state of Minnesota as a whole. So so we can both be, you know, laser focused on ensuring that we are limiting the amount of fraud and calculation errors, and at the same time invest in a program that has produced positive outcomes. And I think that that's what this program does.
Okay. Chair Kraskowski?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Well, Mr. Cummings, you know, we can trust and hope and, you know, think that our government's doing a wonderful job. The track record here in the state of Minnesota of Department of Human Services, as you know, is very poor. The Medicaid eligibility verification has been chronicled over the last 10 years and talked about by myself and others on the House floor last year, and included in several bills has shown millions and millions and millions of dollars being poured out fraudulently, wastefully, and abusively, the taxpayers' money. So for us just to hope that our government, when we have millions and millions of dollars going out and hope that things are going well, is not a good answer. The federal report that Representative Anderson was dissecting suggests that for the earned income tax credit, that a majority of the taxpayers who overclaimed it were never eligible for it in the first place. That's fraud. And so for us to not have anything in place in the state of Minnesota to ensuring that this disguised welfare program is not doing what it's supposed to do and that the people eligible for it are actually getting it and the people ineligible for it are not getting it, is a lack of us as a legislature doing our job to make sure that the law is being followed. It's a lack of our duty. So Mr. Cummings, I don't know, and Representative Loeffler, I think a great addition to your bill would to actually be to build in a report similar to what the federal folks did with the earned income tax credit, because we don't have anything here in Minnesota. We don't know if the people who are supposed to be getting it are not, are or are not, and if the people who are not supposed to be getting it are or are not getting it. We are remiss in our duties if the first amendment to this part of law should be one that actually makes sure the law is being followed properly. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Kraskowski. Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that in all tax programs, no matter what we're talking about in this committee, whether it's estate taxes, it's corporate taxes, it's property tax refunds, I think, you know, the motto that we hear repeated by Mr. Cummings of everybody pays their fair share, not more, not less, I think is always our goal. And but I don't think that we should disproportionately express concern about any one program without more information about what the situation is in Minnesota, which I think my understanding is Congress and the feds have actually even made changes based on that so that we're in a different circumstance, even in terms of the federal credit at this point in time. And hopefully that's what we always do. We learn as we do things. And like I say, I think that there's a lot of people who go through divorce and they both want to claim that child who they love and adore, and they're not intending to in any way defraud the state or the federal government. They just haven't had it clarified that it can't go to both. And I think that you know, if there are ways to clarify that and make this, you know, a program in which everybody steps up accurately and honestly and gets what they deserve, I think that's our goal always. But I think that these are hardworking taxpayers. They're some of the hardest working people we have, making the least amount of money for the hours that they're putting in on the jobs and the taxes that they're paying. And this program does provide a preventative safety net for many who are right at that verge of homelessness and ending up in the shelter.
Chair Kaskowski. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Loeffler, you know, intent or the intent is fine. If you've got, so you've got, and it, you read into part of the report that I was reading too. You know, there's speculation that maybe these are situations where you've got mom over here and dad over here and they're both applying for the credit and that's the fraud. It doesn't matter what the intent is. The question is our government following the law and making certain that the law is followed properly? Because when it's not, the people who are offended are the people whose money is being taken from them to pay for this welfare program. That's the frustration. And that's the frustration that my constituents share. And many of them share even the frustration that this program even exists. So if we don't do our job and make sure at least a program that does exist in law is not being followed properly, we are offending every taxpayer out there that's paying for it.
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to note, so I thank Representative Drazkowski for his thoughts. I just wanted to note that there was a mention to say that the Department of Revenue is doing nothing. And that's just not, that's not correct. And I apologize to the committee that I'm not able to share more about what is being done or the sort of audit criteria that happens in order to ensure that we are moving to ensure that all taxpayers are reporting and paying the right amount. And you know, I'm going to go back to my shop to see what we can share with the committee, but I didn't want to leave the committee with the impression that the Department of Revenue is doing nothing, because that is certainly not the case. Whether it is a taxpayer that's reporting a small amount of income or a taxpayer that's reporting a lot, we apply the same standard. And we, so I'm going to make sure to get back to this committee with some additional information, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. I think some members would appreciate that. Representative, are you okay? All right. Representative Markowitz.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I think this is a good discussion, talking about scrutiny of programs and so forth, and I hope we someday take a look at all of our tax expenditures someday, because they kind of get into the dark of night, and once a credit or something gets in there, you know, you never ever really review it again. So I would welcome that. But I do find it interesting, with all the scrutiny and all the angst I'm hearing on this credit for low to middle income working folks, when we heard an R&D credit, we heard a Section 179 credit that spent a lot more money, which I support, but no scrutiny. But when we've got a program here that rewards work and family for folks who are trying to work their way up to make the American dream and to make Minnesota a better state, we're going to scrutinize that one. We're going to really put the hammer down. And I find that really interesting, because this is actually a program that the studies show work. The Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis have looked at a lot of studies on the earned income tax credit. Increases the rate of employment for single mothers. Reduces child poverty. These are studies. Reduces welfare caseloads. It provides a work incentive for when people leave welfare, they stay on work. And, you know, all of us here, we're making at least $31,141 a year. And I don't take the maximum per diem, but I know some of us do. And so that's another maybe $5,000 or $6,000, $7,000 a year. So all of us are sitting at minimum, even if we don't work any other, do anything else, we're making $38,000 a year here. And yet we're talking about folks, if you're working all year, minimum wage, $19,700. That's kind of the range we're talking about. And if you take the average of the earned income tax credit, and the average that Minnesotans make on this, $740, it's about $2,800. About $2,800, which is about 14% of that $19,000. But even adding that on, they're up to $22,000. We're at $38,000. And I know we get scrutinized too. But boy, and it doesn't just go to pay for taxes owed to the state. It's also, the intent of it when it first came in was to also offset payroll taxes, which is 7.65%. And God forbid if you got a few extra dollars to spend to try to work your way up, which these are used for. Child care, to go back and get some training to further yourself, to pay for health insurance or to repair a car and get transportation to help yourself move your way up the ladder, to hit the American dream. And we all benefit when we do that. When people are making more and people are employed, we benefit as a state. And this program does that. For, you know, we talk about strategic, targeted tax relief for people where it helps the most. This is one of those programs. It really is. And, you know, I think it should be scrutinized. Every program should. But to spend and make this sound like it's a fraudulent program, I saw in Wadena County 20% of the filers get this credit. 20% out in Wadena County. That's huge. That's the backbone out there. These are the people that are working the backbone that do a lot of services that help all of us. And we somehow, because it's a low, it involves low income, it's going to get a lot more scrutiny today from this committee. And I'm going to, you know, most of these folks are in the second decile. And those who know about the tax incident study, that's about 12,000 to 20,000 income. They pay 12.1% of their income in state and local taxes. Other than the first decile, which is kind of an anomaly, that's the highest rate of any decile. And these folks we're talking about today are paying 15% more of their income in state and local taxes than someone making over $500,000. That's not right. This helps reduce that income disparity. There are so many positives to this. Is any program perfect? No. It is not. But I'm quite frankly, I'm bemused and disappointed with kind of what I'm hearing here. Yes, can we look at things and scrutinize programs? Yes. But then let's scrutinize every single credit that comes through here. Let's not just pick on those people who are trying to make a better life for themselves. This is a good program. And Mr. Chair, you don't like this. You know, this program started federally in 1975. And the first major expansion, the Tax Reform Bill of 1986. Ronald Reagan was the president, and not only did he support the bill, he proposed the expansion, and he was the first one to start indexing the earned income tax credit. Speaker Ryan, strong support of adding, this is bipartisan. And so I don't understand it. I mean, this is actually one of the best bills we're going to hear all year here that actually has an impact on things we want to do, lower welfare caseloads, lower child poverty, increase employment for single mothers. This does that. So, members, I know we get caught in the politics sometimes and so forth, but this is a good program, and it helps people who need it the most. And I just hope, really, when we wind up with a tax bill at the end of the year, that this is in here. It was in last year's tax bill, and I think probably all of us around this table supported that tax bill. It was in there. Let's do it again.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. We've got Representative for Chair Carlson, Lash, Schultz, and Slocum. So,
Mr. Chairman, did you say I was next?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm going to go in a little different direction because I think there's a positive in the bill that we haven't really talked about, and that's lowering the age to 21 for independent individuals. And my question is, because we try to wrestle with that financial aid and other programs, and there's different definitions, both federal and state. So what is the definition of independent relative to this program? And then I have a follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, So thank you for drawing attention to this provision. This is the one that most draws off of Speaker Ryan's proposal from last year. For purposes of this credit, you need to not be claimed as a dependent by another taxpayer. That would be one of the main things that would make the distinction between it being independent and not.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Carlson, asking about that. As most of you know, I'm a now retired teacher, and I'd be out shopping, and every once in a while I would run into one of my former students who was a recent graduate. She might introduce me to her husband, or he might introduce me to his wife. Sometimes they even had a child with them when they were out shopping, and they would have been recent graduates. I would say probably in some of those instances, and I know the average for marriage and so on is going up through the years, but they probably typically the ones I'm talking about maybe 19, 20 years old, and they still wouldn't qualify. So I think you're moving in the right direction, but I think there's another category of young people out there that are just starting out that have gotten married at a younger age or started a family at a younger age, whatever their marital status happens to be, that still don't qualify, and they're living independently. A few years ago wrapping at one of the apartments in my district, and Mr. Carlson, and they told me, reminded me who they were, and they were living out at that point in Robbinsdale. I had been teaching at Edison Northeast, but they had moved into the Robbinsdale area, and they fell into that category I was talking about. They were living in an apartment there and independent, and I don't know if they had a child or not. They both came to the door because they were both Edison graduates. So we're moving in the right direction. The only thing I'm advocating is that maybe at some point in the future we ought to talk about that group that's probably recently out of high school but chose to get married at a younger age or start a family at a younger age. So I'll stop there. I'm not necessarily looking for a response. I just wanted to point out what I perceive as a real positive in the bill and moving in a positive direction.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. Representative Loeffler?
And just to clarify, if they have a dependent, there is no age limitation. So that 18-year-old parent, the 19-year-old parent, they would qualify. Age 21 is for people who don't have dependents.
And Mr. Chair, I might just say, in the examples I was using, I don't know if they had a child or not. Some did, but you know, the example I used in the apartment, I don't know if they had a child or not, but they were married. So at any rate, there is that category, but I'm glad to hear that they would qualify if they had a child, but I'd still have some concern about those that are starting out in life. And, you know, usually when you're in that category starting out in life, you're going to probably be low income. Mm-hmm. Just whatever your choice of occupation, you're just getting started. And I don't think it hurts to give them a boost. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. Chair Lesh or Representative Lesh?
Either or is fine, Mr. Chair.
I'm sure you chair the committee at some point.
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question, Mr. Chair, is for Mr. Cummings. Mr. Cummings, can you tell me, I see here in one of the briefs that the
Representative Lesh, could you use the microphone, please?
Well, yeah, but then, Mr. Chair, I was taught that you look someone in their eye when you're shiving them, and I got to turn away. But I'm not going to shiv him, Mr. Chair.
Here's one over here.
Okay.
This one over here, then you can shiv.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Cummings, actually, my question is, I saw in one of the briefs that the proposal for Representative Loeffler's bill is, I think, $93 million revenue note, and then 97 in the out years. So what is what's the current payout of the tax credit, but for Representative Loeffler's bill? What are we paying out?
Mr. Cummings or Ms. Madden?
Even ballpark is fine.
Does this work? Yep.
260?
I'm going to leave this to Ms. Manzi.
Ms. Manzi, do you have an answer for Representative Lesh?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, the current projection for tax year 2007 is $266 million for the state working family credit. 17. I'm sorry, did I say 7? Okay. 2017, the current tax year. $266 million, 337,400 recipients.
Say that number again. How many recipients?
337,400.
Recipients. Okay, thank you.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chair, so is there any way to determine, because Representative Marquardt's question got me thinking, is there any way, I'm sure there is, and I don't know what you call this, because when we're giving money to government units, we have runs that we determine, you know, how much money is your district getting. But are there charts that show where this money is going? So you have that. Is that in our packet? I'm not even looking at it? Okay. All right. Good. Thanks. So so based on that chart, maybe I should just ask Representative Marquardt, since he studied, did his homework, and I did, Mr. Chair. What is the percentage difference between who gets that in the metro, seven county metro, versus who gets it in greater Minnesota?
Ms. Madden, do you have an answer for him?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, 48% of the households who currently get the credit are in greater Minnesota and 52% in the seven county metro.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I just, you know, in the interest of making America great again, I'm just trying to figure out who we're sticking it to in criticizing this tax credit. But I do, I also want to make sure, Mr. Chair, that we're aware of what Representative Marquardt said, $266 million. Now, you all just rushed your first bill through here at the beginning of the session. You didn't ask any of these questions. Okay, $266 million is chump change compared to the projected health care cost of $87 billion in 5 years from now. $87 billion, okay? You know, the difference between a million and a billion is 1,000. So there's 1,000 times more relevancy that you have in making asking questions about that bill than you have about this one. And you know how many questions there were about it? Nothing. In fact, the answer was, don't worry about it, we'll work out in conference committee. Zero questions. But if poor people are getting any kind of money, or folks that are trying to work to get back on their feet, there's no questions. And I just want to say, I think the testifier left. I wish you didn't leave, Mr. Chair, because I wish she's up there. So this is what you get, okay? This is what you have in charge in the Minnesota House right now, are folks that are sweating whether or not you're getting dimes. And there are corporations that are run through this body getting tens of billions of dollars, of taxpayer dollars. And all those questions they ask about, oh, I think there's some fraud going on here. You know, none of those questions were asked about that bill. But now we're getting questions about this bill. This is what you got. This is why voting is that important. So $266 million, Mr. Chair. And I think it's going to be fantastic to look at if this goes in the final tax bill, which members voted for this, and where the folks that are getting the benefits from this, where they live. And it's absolutely going to get brought up because, yes, I am so disgusted. If there's a chance of fraud, absolutely right. We should be asking questions about it. But we need to be asking those same questions about every single bill. And if it's 1,000 times more relevant, there's 1,000 times more reason to be asking those questions about whether fraud has gone on. But none of that happened. And that's truly revealing, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Ms. Baker.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Representative Richard Auerbach.
You know, Representative Lesh, I must have missed that meeting where you talked about $87 billion of tax benefits to corporations. Can you tell me what tax bill or what issue that was?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh, that's Senate File 1. We voted on it on the floor. It was a health care bill where your caucus proposed to completely turn over the health care system in Minnesota and form a new government program that involved giving expenditures to corporations. I don't know if you recall that.
Representative Lennon, the entire state general fund budget is only a little over $20 billion a year. It's not $87 billion. Senate File 1 spent a little over $300 million, a little bit more than we spend on the working family credit. Like I say, I wasn't there for that discussion, I guess. At least I don't remember an $87 billion bill, but that's why I was asking about it.
Well, Mr. Chernobyl,
thank you. You're revealing, Chernobyl, a distinction without a difference. Healthcare corporations spend dollars publicly and privately. From MA in the last year, it's between $8 and $10 billion of expenditures. That's just MA on healthcare.
I'm familiar with it.
So we're still talking tens of billions of dollars. Now, you're talking about audits over here, okay? Yes, you can audit this and determine it, but what they're suggesting you had in Senate File 1, you can't audit. Say, we're going to do audits. They don't use generally accepted accounting principles. You might as well audit this box of donuts right here, and you're going to get the same answer. So there's zero accountability. We all just let that slide through with no issues without asking the questions, because the same dollars of the $87 billion, those are both private and public dollars that are getting spent. You didn't ask any questions about either the public or the private.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, you're correct that we spend somewhere in the neighborhood of $10 billion or so a year on medical assistance, not $87 billion a year. Senate File 1 spent around $300 million. And as recall, the Republican proposal was to actually have an audit, was to have accountability, was to be means tested so that high income people didn't get these benefits. So the governor's proposal didn't have any means testing, was handing out money to even the wealthiest people in the state. Now, he had his reasons for that in terms of easier workability of doing it, and I understand that, but I don't think, Representative Lesh, that your numbers on this are correct. And I think that certainly, you know, there was plenty of scrutiny about how to hand out the $300 million in Senate File 1 in terms of whether we should do it in terms of the governor's plan or some other means testing plan. I certainly think it's accurate to scrutinize this. I agree with the other comments that were made that I think we should scrutinize all the credits, the R&D credit and stuff too. We don't want to be handing out money that people don't deserve, but we're not spending $87 billion, Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Lesh.
You know, again, Chair Knobloch, you're recognizing a distinction without a difference. Yes, not all of the $87 billion are public expenditures for health care, but the same doctor that provides that medical procedure for a private client is doing the same stuff for a public client in terms of how we spend our dollars in the state of Minnesota. And we're still talking tens of billions of dollars, MA or other. There's other expenditures besides MA. So we're still talking billions of dollars versus $266 million. And the amount of scrutiny that went into that is zero. And so, no, the audits that you proposed are worthless, because if you don't use generally accepted accounting principles, you're not comparing apples to apples, as you well know. So you're not going to get a real answer as to whether or not our health care dollars are being properly spent. So when I offered the amendment on a bill and then withdrew it because I knew it was going to go down to actually ask how much do these procedures cost, there was zero interest in asking whether or not there's waste, fraud, and abuse going on in the system. Until we do that, Chernobyl, it's completely pointless, because the healthcare companies come back and say, yeah, trust me, this procedure costs $45,000, pony up, and we say, okay, and there's no questions about that. That's why expenditures are $87 billion across private and public. And this, $266 million, for people who are just trying to get by, chump change compared to that, which is why I think Representative Marcoy pointed out the hypocrisy in the entire line of questioning on this bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, we don't spend $87 billion on health care in Minnesota a year with public, private, or everything else put together. We don't, sir. We don't.
Okay. We're going to move on to Representative Schultz.
I thought I was on the taxes committee, Mr. Chair. But I'm happy to talk about health care. So I want to go back. I am so thankful for my colleagues to point these things out, that this line of questioning. I just want to point out one thing. I think with limited resources in our Department of Revenue, where we target those resources and hours of labor in detecting fraud, we're going to get much more value for the wealthy tax filers than we are for the lowest income in terms of the return on what we spend on labor in investigating fraud. So I think we have to be mindful of where we should concentrate our limited resources when we go after fraud and abuse in our tax system. And I think where we're going to get the most revenue back is from those wealthier taxpayers than from low-income tax filers who may just have not consciously made a mistake, and it's $10 or $20 that we discover.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. I would think that the tax bill applies to all taxpayers. But next on the list is Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to shiv anybody, but that was pretty good. I just want to say this is really a bipartisan issue. The earned income credit was Nixon's initial idea. And then, as Representative Marquardt explained, expanded by Ronald Reagan. We're trying to be nonpartisan here. Let's get over the partisanship and vote for this good bill.
Thank you, Representative Slocum. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the comments by Representative Lesch reminded me of something that when we're dealing with these tax credits, and we've had some pretty big ones coming through here, we don't really spend the time we should on what the long-term costs. You know, you can talk about this biennium, the next biennium. I can't tell you when I chaired the Finance Committee and Ways and Means. In fact, I've chaired fiscal committees most of my time in the legislature. The number of times I would counsel members and chairs about the tails. You know, and I don't think we really spend much time on that. So when some business group comes in and we talk about the credit that they're advocating for or expansion, we don't really talk about other than the revenue note that might show this biennium and the next biennium. But once a lot of those credits are put in place, they're long term. And yes, you do then get up into hundreds of millions and even cross the billion line if you begin to look at, let's say, a 10-year window on some of those. So I would just point out that that's something that, at least on the finance side, the appropriation side, and I'm sure Representative Knobloch or hopefully looks at the tails question. You know, I sit down with authors and so on, and we would come up with amendments and ideas because you'd like to help them move their idea along, but you also have to balance the budget. And I would reinforce some of what Representative Lesch was saying about if we're going to scrutinize programs in high detail, we do all of them because they are costly. And we're committing, even though we're theoretically not committing future legislatures, realistically we really are on any number of things. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, we are scrutinizing other incentive programs. In fact, just this week, the legislative auditor came out a report on the R&D tax credit. In fact, it came out this morning, I think. That was all part of the state government finance bill from 2015. In there, Representative Berry at the time, he had a piece of legislation that said the legislative auditor would do a review of economic incentives in the state so that we're going to get periodic review of these incentives. And what we're asking here, when we're looking at this piece in particular, the federal government, President Obama's Treasury Department, said this has the highest level of fraud, overpayments, abuse, whatever you want to call it. The highest, not even in the ballpark of 10%. We're talking about 39% of overpayments, fraud, abuse problems that we're talking about in this place. And why wouldn't we want to check into that? Why wouldn't we want to know that $67 million could be placed somewhere else? Could be placed with education? Could be placed with transportation? Anywhere else that we have needs here in the state? Back to the taxpayer. I think that that's our responsibility. We are putting together a budget. Our responsibility is making sure that the tax dollars are being spent wisely, efficiently, and that they're going to the people that we say that we want to help. I think that's what we should be focusing on.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Rothler, do you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this program has been one of the most researched programs, and in particular at the federal level, in terms of its long-term impacts and short-term impacts on family stability and the positive outcomes for those workers and their children. And I think if we're going to look at the value of a program, we have to look at the outcomes, not just whether everybody filled out the form right, which we want and we need to be diligent on and we need to hold people accountable for, but we also have to celebrate that we have long-term been in a program that has been proven to stabilize the lowest income workers in our state, the people who don't get a break on hardly anything. And we talk about all kinds of tax breaks in this committee that benefit people who have very sophisticated tax advisors and finance advisors who will teach them how the system works and how to structure their portfolio and their wealth in a way that advantages them. These are the people who are working for $9 an hour, minimum wage, scrapping by, turning down public benefits because they're proud of having a job. They'll be like Kalina and her family. You lose a job, you take one that takes less just because you want to have a job. And why shouldn't we step up and help those people? And as Chair Marquardt mentioned, they pay a higher percentage of their total income in sales taxes and property taxes and other state and income taxes than most of the higher income people in Minnesota. And it's a proven program that has been shown to stabilize families, get them off to a good start, help them on the road to being the kind of productive families and community members that we all want and celebrate in our communities. And it's a pretty small ask compared to many of the bills that we've looked at to help a huge amount of people, almost 400,000 households. That's a lot of people, and they're in every single district in the state. They're disproportionately in certain parts of Minnesota, and they're stepping up. They're going to work every day, even though their job doesn't pay them much more than the basics. And I think we ought to honor those people and make sure that they're included in our final tax bill, and I appreciate the time of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. With that, Representative Loeffler renews her motion to lay House File 516 as amended for possible inclusion in the very probable tax omnibus bill.
On the record.
Meeting is adjourned.